Barton George, and I'm on the phone today with Tim Bray. Tim, how are you doing?
Not too bad.
Great. And you're the director of web technologies at Sun Microsystems and have a bunch of background in the area, don't you?
Well, and as I claimed, everything that Sun sells is a web technology, so it's all mine.
I like that. Very good. So speaking of web technologies, if we just sort of zoom out and look at the web today at a real sort of macro level, what do you think? How would you opine on the state of the web today? What are some of the things that you think are the key interesting bits at this point?
Well, maybe it's just because I'm an engineer, but it seems to me that a lot of the most interesting action has been happening behind the scenes in the engine room rather than out front where you can see it. I mean, if you think of really surprising, startling, interesting new things that have arrived on the web, well, we got Twitter in 2006, and what has come along since then that's really a game changer? Well, maybe Google Wave, but that's definitely, you know, to be determined. Back behind the scenes where people are building web applications, there have been a whole lot of changes. And essentially, every year it gets easier to move from having a good idea to having it on the air, and then having something on the air and ramping it up to an incredibly huge web scale. Both of those things continue to get easier and more straightforward as the years go by, and thus help to enable the people who want to put their good ideas out in front of the world.
Well, so, and you just mentioned Twitter there, and so if we dive a little bit deeper into that, and more on the sort of the engineering and the plumbing side of it, now they recently came out that they're going to be moving on the back end away from Ruby on Rails, which you have been a big champion of, to, is it pronounced Scala?
Well, that's actually not quite correct. Their front end that actually serves web pages was originally Ruby on Rails and still is Ruby on Rails.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a bunch of back-end queuing software, because as you can imagine, what Twitter really is this immensely huge queuing and routing engine to route the tweets around. And that has been implemented and re-implemented and re-implemented, and they have tried a variety of technologies for that. Now, it has been, fairly public that they've been experimenting with Scala, but although nobody knows exactly what they're doing except for themselves, there's a bunch of other technologies involved in that as well. So they certainly have not walked away from Ruby on Rails. They're still using Ruby on Rails for what it's good for, and they have, one of the world's hardest queuing and routing problems in their back end that they continue to, actually, I would say, do a pretty good job this last year or so of scaling up to meet.
So looking more generally at dynamic languages, what are some of the other ones out there that you find particularly interesting or you see as potentially game changers going forward?
Well, in terms of headcount, PHP is still the big dog, of course. The two biggest web developer communities are clearly the Java community and the PHP community. Now, in terms of growth, though, I think that the big stars are obviously Python and especially Ruby, in particular Ruby because of the Rails web framework. I also think that for the community of professional web developers who care a lot about maintainability and reliability and things like that, the nice, clean, object-oriented designs of languages like Python and Ruby make them particularly more attractive. And as a result, as the enterprise buys into modern web frameworks, I suspect they're more likely to buy in at the Python and Ruby end. The Python and Ruby both occupy, very similar spaces in the ecosystem. They're much more alike than different. What's new? Well, last year we had the JVM Languages Summit at Sun, and gosh, there was some interesting new technology. In particular, there is a language called Clojure, which is a Lisp, which seems to have some very smart stuff for concurrent programming and so on that got a lot of buzz. Now, I'm not convinced that any Lisp is ever going to really become a mainstream enterprise kind of thing, but nonetheless, it's interesting in terms of indicating what kind of technologies are becoming popular. Other dark horses, this 20-year-old Swedish telephone switch programming language, Erlang, continues to have substantial buzz because it may not be glamorous and sexy, and it's not even object-oriented, but by golly, it can, build some amazingly robust and performant and highly concurrent systems.
You were at Erlang Factory, were you, just recently?
No, I didn't get to that. I would have very much have liked to, but I did not.
I just met a developer last night who had gone to that and just learned about Erlang, so it's interesting that you bring it up.
Well, Erlang is you know, tremendously compelling in terms of some of the lessons it has to teach. In particular these days when our CPUs are no longer getting faster, but they're getting wider, you know, the only way to achieve better performance is through concurrency. And, you know, Erlang radically rejects the thread programming model that's popularized in particular in Java and .NET, where you have global data shared between threads, and has a rigid functional programming message passing based model that is sure a whole lot easier to understand than threaded programming. And the other thing Erlang has is it was designed to operate telephone switches that simply cannot be taken off the air for years at a time. And thus it has a bunch of features for accepting that failure is a regular part of a program's life and dealing with it in a way that doesn't take you off the air. So I have to tell you, if somebody were to offer me a chunk of money to build a large distributed system that had to deal with a lot of events and message passing and would be extremely robust and long-lived, I would, you know, give serious thought to building it in Erlang.
That's very cool. Now, getting back to a subject you'd mentioned in the beginning, Wave, as you say, it still needs to be proven. But what are some of your thoughts around that? And do you believe this thing that that some people have been saying, Wave means HTTP is dead?
Well, I think we can all agree that in no uncertain terms that HTTP is not dead. You know, HTTP is incredibly popular for a huge variety of application scenarios. You know, the Wave guys are making the assertion that for conversational style applications, they have something better. You know, who knows? Is this, you know, a new Twitter, something that solves a few problems really well and becomes wildly popular, or is it the new Lotus Notes, something that solves 11 problems, none of them particularly well, and is forced down people's throats by management? You know, we just don't know yet. I tend to be a little bit nervous and suspicious of something that's trying to do so many things at once. You know, most of the really big innovations on the internet have been things that solved one problem reasonably well and, you know, didn't try to boil the ocean.
So the other thing that I wanted to chat with you about is what you're seeing out there in the space of the browsers, right? So you have IE, who's about 65%, Firefox 22%, Safari 8%, Chrome is nudging up to 2%, and you've got
right.
Opera that's nudging up to 1%. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I tend to be fairly radically a radical subscriber to the belief that competition is good, that, you know, a market with more than one browser is better than a market with only one browser, and a market with more than two is better than one with only two. Now, that falls off at some point. You know, it's not beneficial to have more. But you know, we're pretty close to a good size where a serious web designer that wants to you know, appeal to even you know, a large majority of people has to make sure they do cross-browser compatibility. Now, in terms of the actual technical capabilities, it's clearly the case that Internet Explorer is lagging behind the crowd, you know, really embarrassingly. The performance and capabilities of the latest releases of Safari and Firefox and Chrome are really remarkable, surprising. And portable, too. I mean, I have an Android phone, and I have a very high-quality implementation of WebKit, which is Safari, on there. So we do have this tension where, you know, slightly more than half the population is using a browser that is demonstrably not as good as what everybody else is using. And that I suspect, probably will continue to drift down that market share. But who knows? It's hard to predict. What we do know is that, you know, cross-browser compatibility is a big deal. That's easier than it used to be, and furthermore, for most people, they deal with Java with Ajax libraries that just make the problem go away. But it's a wonderful time, you know, for those of us who live a browser-centered world. Things are getting better all the time.
And where would you say HTML5 plays in here? Do you think that Firefox has the market momentum to really make this technology mainstream?
Well, HTML5 is sort of two or three separate things at one time. To start with, they're introducing a few new tags to HTML. You know, most obviously things like video and canvas, which are brain-dead obvious good ideas. I mean, anybody who's ever had to embed video in a web page knows how kludgy and fragile and brittle that is. And having just a video element that says, you know, put the pointer here and the browser figures out what to do, that has to be a step forward, obviously. And Canvas clearly, you know, is something that will empower the development of better and richer Ajax applications. So that part of HTML5 is clearly, you know, a good thing and is seeing, you know, pretty rapid uptake from a variety of the browser providers, not just Firefox. But you know, the other half of HTML5 is this political, personality-studded, difficult, large working group, which has this radical notion of, you know, sort of redefining the semantics of tags, and they're going to totally characterize the behavior of an HTML parser, including every possible imaginable error condition. And they believe that if they do this with sufficient detail, then you'll have 100% browser compatibility forever. And who knows? They may be right. It strikes me as a fairly, you know, far-fetched idea, but nobody's ever tried it, and we won't know until somebody does. They also point out that they're not likely to, you know, reach that goal for some fairly large number of years, and I can't myself see anything further than about 6 months ahead on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as HTML5 goes, yeah, I love video and Canvas. As regards the larger project, you know, it's we'll have to see.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, with the small player, Opera recently announced Unite, idea of taking web browsing and file serving and putting them together. Any mm-hmm. thoughts about that? Is that sort of a back to the future kind of a deal?
Well, you know, those ideas have been floating around for years and years and years and years and years. You know, Dave Weiner, the sort of the proto-blogger, had been proposing something like this, 12 years ago or something like that. And clearly, it's a powerful idea. And, you know, it's not just at the small device level. I don't know if you've been watching some of the, in the web service and cloud technology space, there's this notion of webhooks, mm-hmm. which is, well, I ask you to do something, and instead of waiting for you to do it, I send you a URL, and when you're finished, you post back to my URL to tell me you're done. And that's called a webhook. And for that to work, of course, I have to have a web server so that there'll be something for you to post to. So this notion of having, you know, web conversations that are two-directional and having web servers in lots of little devices so that they can, you know, you can send the messages and they react to events is clearly a very powerful and compelling idea. So I'm not smart enough to predict how it's going to play out in the particular case of what Opera is doing, but I've long been a fan of the basic core idea there.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the things I saw in your blog recently, you talked about being Kindled and the business model there. And so maybe tell us a little bit about that, and then also more generally some of the business models you're seeing that are actually working in the web.
Well, you know, I have a blog, and it's fairly popular. It's very hard to know how many readers you have, but I have on the order of 50,000 subscribers anyhow. And I don't run ads because I never got much money doing it. And furthermore, you know, I work for Sun, and I'm not sure it would be entirely appropriate. But there's this notion where you can go to kindlepublishing.com and sign up for your blog, and then anybody can subscribe to get it delivered to their Kindle. And it goes for either 99 cents or $1.99 a month, of which they keep 70% and you get 30, which sounds outrageous, but it's not terribly out of line with book publishing royalties. And my blog was deemed by them to be worth principally $1.99 a month, so I signed up. This is just a couple of weeks ago. I don't anticipate that, you know, it'll make me rich. I am more interested in whether or not the business model actually works than that's my motivation for investigating that. As to what works, well, you know, Google has proven that there's, you know, a huge pot of gold in intelligently deployed advertising. Nobody else has gotten quite the leverage out of that Google has. I mean, I tend to look at companies like 37 Signals, who do very, very well on a straight fee-for-service model. They provide, you know, online project management and to-do list and notification tools and so on, and you sign up for a very small number of dollars a month, and they're doing quite nicely, thank you. And mm-hmm. and I think there's a lot of virtue in the old-fashioned model of providing a service that people, you know, sign up and pay for. You know, works for cable TV and lots of other organizations, so why shouldn't it work on the web?
Very cool. And then last but not least, what is the thing that you're most excited about right now in the web coming up, say, in the next year?
I think the whole ferment in the area of databases is, there's a bunch of things. So let me give you two, okay?
Sure, please do.
The whole ferment in the area of databases is tremendously exciting. You know, the notion that everything had to be relational and had to have ACID semantics is being challenged from multiple directions. And things, you know, very large offerings like Facebook and so on, you know, no longer go that way. They have these various kinds of distributed key values pair stores that don't offer transactional semantics. They provide eventual consistency and amazingly high throughput and successful distributed operation and so on. And And, you know, it's kind of like being back in the late 70s, early 80s when, you know, the various types of databases, you know, network and relational and so on, were duking it out. Well, relational won. Well, we're back to duking it out again. There are going to be new kinds of databases, and eventually I suspect that one flavor of them will emerge. But, you know, we're seeing these names of technologies that didn't exist 2 years ago, like CoachDB and Tokyo Cabinet and Project Voldemort and so on, which, you know, do really remarkably clever and interesting things. So that's tremendously interesting to me, the whole issue of, you know, what's the right way to persist data at scale. Then on the other side, I'm, like everybody else in the industry, convinced that the mobile platform is astoundingly important. And, you know, right at the moment, this is great fun because we have three really interesting smartphones. Well, four if you count the BlackBerry, although it's more seen as an email device. But you've got the iPhone, obviously, which is going from strength to strength. You've got the Android model. And then you've got the Palm Pre now, which... And they all have, you know, radically different models of how you should develop software. You know, the iPhone is Objective-C compiled to the metal, learn a new language, learn a new framework. Android is totally vanilla Java with a rather nice framework. And they can't say it's Java because it isn't really Java.
Right,
It's the Java programming language compiled to a different platform. Palm Pre is WebOS, where everything's done in JavaScript and HTML and CSS. And you could make interesting theoretical arguments where each one of those is a winning model. But you don't have to, because, you know, the market's going to decide, right?
Right.
We've got well-funded parties in each case shipping pretty darn sweet hardware, and we'll find out, you know, which of these models plays well. I'd be astounded if one of them, you know, conquered all. But, you know, it's just going to be great, huge fun to watch.
Excellent. Well, Tim Bray, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it, and it'd be interesting to check in a few months or a year and see how things have progressed along.
And see if, you know, the usual miserable failure rate of predictions about the web continues to persist.
Exactly. There you go. Alrighty. Thanks so much.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.